I want to welcome everyone to the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace teleconference with our special guest, Ted Malik. Today is September 22nd, 2009, and today is actually the release date of Ted's new book, Being Generous, and that's what we're going to be talking about. So I want to give you just a brief overview of the way we're structuring the call. I will begin by reading just a brief quote from Ted's
book. Daniel Wood.
Hi, thank you. Welcome. I'm going to begin by reading a quote and then asking for a moment of silence so that we can all connect in spirit and in faith together. And then I'll introduce Ted. And Ted and I will talk for about 20 minutes. Hopefully, mostly that's Ted talking, not me. I'll be asking him just a few questions. And then about a half an hour into the call, we'll open it for questions and comments and have a dialogue with anybody that's on the call that would like to participate. And it's also perfectly quiet, fine to just be quiet and listen if that's what you prefer to do. We'll end with a closing reading from Ted's book, Being Generous, and then I will ask Ted to make our very last closing comment, whatever is in his heart to share with us. This call is being recorded, and so do be aware that we can hear all background noise unless you have muted by using star 6. And when we get to the participatory part of the call, then...
Vernon Grant.
Thank you. Hi, Vernon. I'm going to ask that you mute yourself by doing star 6, and later I'll have everybody unmute when we get involved in the dialogue. Okay. So it's time for an opening reflection, and this is a quote from Ted's book, Being Generous. Ted writes, "Generosity is rooted in the things people feel and do. It is a virtue, a habit that shapes and governs a way of life. It influences expectations, causing people to look at the world as though others, not themselves, are the principal reason for the world's existence. It is my hope that in the new world of connectedness to which we are advancing, the virtue of generosity will find fertile ground, that it will spread through the world as peace spreads through a congregation, or good cheer through a carnival. I see the overthrow of the paradigms of the past. Much that is stale and out of date is vanishing. We are beginning to share our traditions, religions, and moral philosophies, and we appear to be ready in our increasing affluence to forge something new, a global civilization based on spiritual information." Please join me in a moment of silence.
Sharon Kelly.
Sharon, welcome. We're sharing a moment of silence, so please join us. Thank you, everyone. And if you haven't muted, just one last reminder, star 6 will mute you, and later on star 6 will also unmute you. So I would like to introduce Ted Malik to all of you, this wonderful community stretched all over the place. Ted, whose full name is Theodore Roosevelt Malik, is chairman and CEO of the Roosevelt Group, a leading strategic advisory and thought leadership company. He's also the founder and chairman of a very interesting not-for-profit called Spiritual Enterprise Institute, and I hope that, Ted, you'll tell us a little bit more about that on this call. The Spiritual Enterprise Institute was created in 2005. Ted has served in leadership positions at PricewaterhouseCoopers, the Aspen Institute, the CNN World Economic Development Congress, the World Economic Forum, the United Nations, and he's held senior positions in the U.S. State Department and in the U.S. Senate. He's also authored or co-authored 7 books, including the very popular book Spiritual Enterprise, Doing Virtuous Business. Ted has written numerous journal articles, corporate and governmental research reports, and research reports, and has appeared frequently on television and webcasts as a keynote speaker. So keep that in mind if you're looking for an inspiring speaker. And I've known Ted for several years. He's a real pioneer in this field of faith and spirituality in the workplace. And Ted is particularly a champion of the idea of spiritual capital and has been studying the connection between virtuous organizations and competitive performance for quite some time. He's also becoming a very dear friend and a wonderful colleague in this field. And Ted, it's just such an honor to have you here with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Judy, for inviting me and restarting this good thing that you have been doing for so many years. I'm so pleased that you're now located there at the Walton School of Business and the Tyson Center. It's exciting.
Yeah, thank you. It sure is exciting for me and for the field, too, to know that this kind of a center exists at a public university. So I'm glad that you're here today. I'd like to ask you to start by telling us, how did you get interested in this topic of generosity? You know, it's not a topic that you hear in conversation very much at all.
Well, and that's unfortunate that it's not really a part of our public vocabulary. I would say, though, in answer to this query, I really never had a time in my life when I was disinterested in generosity. I grew up in a family of sacrificial giving, so I was exposed to the virtue of generosity at a very early age, and it was more or less a habit or made a habit. I would say that the spiritual direction that I've discovered later and as we progress through life has certainly added to the dimensions of my understanding and study of generosity, which we'll talk about today, and my activity in philanthropy, both serving on different boards and receiving different grants and running different forums for lead philanthropists, led me into the kind of question that many of them posed is, how does this generosity begin and what is the root of generosity and why give at all? As one of the commentators said about my book, this is also very much for me a personal journey. It's about really my movement or journey in life from being a keeper to being a giver. And in that sense, I hope that it inspires others in other practices and other philosophies and can guide their lives, because this book is really, I would say, meant to be a form of persuasion about this, I would say not forgotten, but this important virtue of generosity. I was challenged at a certain point, and we can come back to this story later, about 5-6 years ago by Sir John Templeton, whose foundation has been generous to underwriting work that research that I've done at the Spiritual Enterprise Institute and some of the books we've written, and now as we move on to Yale University. But his acts of generosity have also been, I would say, somewhat at the core of what I'm writing about here. So that's a long answer to the question that you posed. I'm glad that you started out with the paragraphs in my book that I would have cited myself, so we're really on the same wavelength here, Judy. And I hope that, you know, in this argument we begin to see the virtue of generosity as a new way of being. So I quote Nicholas Negroponte, who wrote that famous book in 1995 about being digital. And my hope is that, as he was accurate about this new world of wireless connection, this digital age that we're now part of, that a new world of generosity, too, can become ubiquitous. So it is an attempt of this sort that brings me to writing this book, to ask what generosity means and what it might entail for everyone in our common future.
And as you talk about the wireless world, and you know, that really means we're invisibly connected. And when you write about generosity, that's really the same thing. It's another form of invisible connection.
Indeed, I think we are at a new place in civilization. That is not to say we give up all of our past histories and traditions, because in many ways I would contend that the future is half inherited and half created, that nothing is ever entirely new under the sun, and that we need to recall constantly the collected wisdom of the ages, that the big questions people have addressed through the ages are still very much with us. They're not going to go away anytime soon. That the great books, certainly those I was brought up on, and I'm sure many of our listeners, are various religious heritages, our sacred literatures, and I think particularly science, and I do spend a good bit of time in this book talking about the science and the economics of generosity. All of these really provide us with a valuable starting point in this new journey.
I'm going to interrupt for a minute.
In that context,
there's some background noise. I'm sorry, I just want to ask this.
Excuse me?
There's background noise that someone hasn't muted, and it sounds like kitchen work, and I thought I heard a dog barking. So I'd just like to ask if you haven't muted in the background, not you, Ted, but anybody else, if you haven't muted, please use *6 so that we have a clearer, it's easier for everyone else to hear. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ted, but to build on what you were saying, you have this phrase called universal moral urge that you talk about in terms of generosity and with all the faith and philosophical traditions. Can you say more about that?
Yes, actually, the first long section of this book is an argument that retraces I don't mean to do this cryptically, but in about 35, 40 pages, all of the world's great religious traditions, including secular humanism, so the last 200 years as well as the 5,000 preceding it. So a review of what the nature of gift and the nature of tithe or of giving is in all these great world religious traditions. And I come to some interesting conclusions. I'm not trying to boil them down into some essentials or to go to some lowest common denominator. I think these are different paths. They're valid paths. They're interesting. But when you look at them, you know, from on high, I think what you could conclude is that together they provide us with a kind of common, universal moral urge that in virtually every tradition that's religious as well as secular, humankind has known. Every faith community on every continent, and also amongst those who are agnostic, there exists a diverse set of teachings that emphasize generosity. So being generous is, in that sense, I would argue, not just a core part of the human condition, but you could call it a universal moral urge, our defining nature. Since generosity so defines our human nature, then it is one of the few things on which people around the entire globe, again, though on different pathways, can agree. And this is a part of the long history of wisdom, whether you go back in our own Christian traditions or in the Jewish Proverbs, fear of God is the beginning of all wisdom, or in any of the great really wisdom literatures. In this wisdom of giving, and of giving generously as a habit, you can trace it back again to pre-modern times, and you can then conclude that generosity as a virtue has long been considered a central, if not the central, part of wisdom. In my argument, and in the presentation then in chapters to follow this first long one, I say that, and this is important to underscore, that giving is not exclusively for the rich. Now, I contradict myself slightly by giving 30 examples of great wealth that has been offered in charity, and we'll talk about some of those examples, but I would remind all of us that the widow gave her mite, which was a very small amount of money, and it was more generous than the rich young ruler. So, in fact, giving is for everyone.
And the other thing to build on that I liked about what you said, because when I first started reading, I was thinking that you were talking about financial generosity and philanthropy. And this book is much broader than that. It includes those things, but you're talking about other forms of generosity as well.
Well, indeed. I think in our materialist culture and at this point in time where finance is so predominant, we tend, whether it's in the not-for-profit world, in the foundations that some of us inhabit, or in the churches and synagogues and mosques that we visit and frequent as worshipers, we tend to overemphasize what is sometimes called treasure. And what I've tried to do here is argue that stewardship really has to do with time, treasure, and talent. So that we can be generous, certainly we need to be, with our treasure, but it is not an exclusive category. This has not only to do with our financial wealth or that asset. It has to do with our entire being, which means then predominantly, and I think more significantly, the use of our time and our talents, which are really not something we monetize. So if we look at it in that very broad scope and try to understand this notion of stewardship and of generous giving from that perspective, it does turn the tables a bit. I'm not, again, excluding finance, and I actually have a whole chapter on economics, and as you know, I have a PhD in international economics, so I'm not going to do that. But I think we sometimes need to be reminded of this broader scope.
Yeah, and I think you do such a beautiful job of that. And you know, had me really thinking about how generous am I with my time, that not just with my financial giving, but and with my listening. And that, you know, there's lots of ways to think about being generous that you really got me thinking. I'd like to move on now to talking about your own faith path as a Christian. And we have people of many faith paths on the call. But what can you say from your tradition in Christianity and your own theology about generosity that could be useful to people of any tradition?
Well, indeed, I've written an entire chapter, and I think it's a core chapter, on the notion of charity and gift. And in that chapter, I dig fairly deeply into my own tradition of Christian thinking, which is rooted in the New Testament, and particularly in the wonderful insights of St. Paul himself. That tradition, I think, is of great relevance, actually, to all serious people, not just to Christians, not least because it is an attempt to spell out in detailed terms exactly what it means to live in the belief that the world is ordered and ordered by a loving God who demands love, not toward himself only, but towards our neighbors. This neighborly love is a distinctive, really, of Christianity. And then you could ask the question, well, who are our neighbors? Obviously those next door, but what about those around the globe, and how intimately are we connected to them now in this integrated global economy? And I would say the parable of the Good Samaritan, amongst others, makes it abundantly clear that neighbors include those whom we come across, but with whom we have no other connection, not one of tribe or of nation or of faith, as is mentioned in Luke's gospel. It is this Christian tradition, when you dig into it deeply, that has actually shaped our entire Western culture and its understanding of the concept of charity as the love to which we are commanded, to use Kant's striking words when he was describing what that charity means. So Christianity, and here I'm not speaking denominationally, and there are obviously many different takes on different traditions, and I respect those, but Christianity is rooted in a conviction that the world is ordered by a loving God who demands love from each of us, love directed not only towards himself, but outward towards our neighbors. And that concept of giving, I would argue, lies at the very heart of Christian theology. Galatians states that Jesus Christ gave himself for our sins that he might deliver us from this present evil world. but also affirmed that Christ loved us, so that he gave himself for us. So it's no wonder then that Paul, in particular, expresses this gratitude with very, very powerful words, thanks be to God for his unspeakable gift. And over again in the New Testament, in different places, you see this argument, and we're told how Christ gave his very life for ourselves. So if you take that argument, you see how sacrificial giving is central to everything that is really identified with Christian living, and this whole notion of charity, caritas in Latin, of course, is the core of this biblical instruction. So we need to go back and remind ourselves of those laws and those commandments.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And you mentioned earlier that you have given several examples. Some of them are Christian leaders and some are leaders from other traditions who are wonderful models for us in generosity. Would you like to share a couple of those?
Well, I would, and indeed, one of the interesting things about this book is, hopefully it's readable. It's not a Dan Brown novel, but it is readable.
It is very readable, and it's inspiring, let me tell you.
I have 30 different examples of human lives that demonstrate, I think quite vividly, although very differently, this virtue of generosity and how it's impacted lives and how demonstrable it has been. The examples go back centuries, and there's some surprising characters that I've chosen. I think after writing this, I found about 60 or 70 more, and now I guess people keep sending me yet again more examples, so hopefully there are an endless number of such examples, which would be a good thing. But I thought I might take a couple of minutes, if I could, to tell you, just shortly, about a couple of these examples, because I think that they, we all like to have real-life examples, case studies, if you will, of people who have been extraordinarily generous, because they're not just good examples, but they are they're really indicative of what's possible. So let me tell you a couple, if you'll bear with me.
Yes, please.
And some of these names, you know, I'm just picking three or four, not quite randomly, but to tell you about. One is Joan Kroc. She died in 2003. You may know her name. She made the largest ever gift to charity. Her estate, as the heiress of the McDonald's business, created by her late husband, remains the largest in the history of the world. She also owned, for those of us who follow baseball, the San Diego Padres. She gave $1.5 billion near the end of her life, 75% of her $2 billion fortune, to the Salvation Army. The gift was for the construction of 30 to 50 recreation and educational facilities across the entire U.S., and her other gift was to go into an endowment whose earnings would pay half of the operating costs of those facilities, so she's mindful of them into the future. She challenged other donors to pay the remainder. She also, and some of us have been there, had started the Institute for Peace and Justice at the University of San Diego, a center for the homeless, an animal shelter, and she made numerous large gifts to Notre Dame University, her alma mater. Her giving is coordinated to support the Ronald McDonald's children's charities and houses. And I think as another witness, quite interestingly, after seeing the devastating effects of a flood, she spontaneously gave $15 million to help rebuild the towns of Grand Forks, North Dakota, and the town across the river in Minnesota. So there's an interesting example of, I would say, a generous individual. A second person I would point to, and this is in a different faith tradition, but a very interesting person who I have met, is a Buddhist who lives in Asia, and his name is, I'm trying to find the story here. His name is Li Ka-shing. He is probably the wealthiest Asian alive. He's a business person. And was born in China. His wealth is estimated at $26 billion. He's the chairman of Hutchison Whampoa and Cheung Kong Holdings. He's based in Hong Kong. His companies are the largest operators of container terminals in the world, and he also has the biggest chain of health and beauty retailers globally. He's known for his thrifty lifestyle, and he has, in the last generation, become, as I said, Asia's most generous philanthropist. He has said to have donated about nearly $1.5 billion to charitable causes. He left Hong Kong as a youth in, under some hardship in 1940. He finished school at age 15. He labored long days and nights and started his own real estate company and then acquired others and branched out into these other businesses. His life has been called by others, not by me, quote, a lesson in integrity and adaptability. And he's always remained true to his internal compass. He's been able to build a business empire. It covers everything from electricity to telecoms to real estate to retail to shipping to the internet. And he has won many honors, including the Order of the British Empire. I think that most notably, he's pledged one-third of all of his wealth to charity, and that led recently to his founding a university near his own hometown in rural China with a Buddhist orientation. He's donated libraries, faculties of medicine, hospitals, and given very generously to aid and relief efforts, particularly after the tsunami and the earthquake disasters. And last year, I believe, maybe the year before, he gave a very large gift to pay for Singapore's Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore. And then maybe I'll give you one other example, which is a bit of a literary example, one that you know, might strike some fancy. There is an author of some repute that I think many of us have come to know. His name was Clive Staples Lewis, C.S. Lewis, also known as Jack. He was born in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and he, of course, became world-renowned in the 1930s and 40s as a medieval scholar. He was an apologist and a poet, a writer, of course, with many titles, most of which relate to the struggle between good and evil. His most famous works, at least to children, I think, and now adults as well, are the Chronicles of Narnia, and they have been translated into more than 30 languages and have sold in excess of 100 million copies since they were published in the 1950s, which makes them some of the biggest-selling books of all time. Of course, many of them have been popularized on stage and TV and now, of course, in the cinema. Well, Jack was a brilliant student at Oxford. He won an unheard-of triple firsts, the highest honor. He went on to teach at Magdalen College, Oxford, for 30 years, and he later served as a professor of medieval and Renaissance literature at Magdalen College at Cambridge. He was a very prolific writer, and what might be less known about him, a very jovial soul. He was part of that literary circle of friends called the Inklings, which include, amongst others, J.R.R. Tolkien, Charles Williams, Owen Barfield, and his brother Warren. And his own personal example of generosity I wanted to mention because I think it's it goes back to the point we were making a minute ago. While he was very quiet and largely unrecorded in his giving, it's well worth mentioning, as is any sincere philanthropy. From a very early age, he was generous with his money, and once when he was a schoolboy, he was punished for giving money to a beggar. I think it stayed with him. He became a very well-known writer, and he In his writings, which were very profitable, he formed a trust called the Agape Fund, which was administered by his friend, also a lawyer, Owen Barfield, and he paid two-thirds of all of his royalties into that fund. And from that fund, Lewis gave generously to nearly always anonymously to people who were in need. He typically gave his grants to private individuals who he discovered had particular personal needs, many of them medical, rather than to charitable institutions or to some large political causes. And one story I'll end with on this. The story is told that when a friend heard that Lewis had given his money to a beggar in Oxford, the friend remarked that he shouldn't have done so because the beggar would only spend the money on alcoholic drink. And Lewis replied, "If I had kept the money, I would only have spent it on drink."
That's
definitely. So I have about 30 of these stories, some of which I think have never been told before, but hopefully they've been collected here and they're interspersed amongst my own arguments so as to enliven it and to make it deeply personal.
And what I appreciate about these stories, too, is the diversity of faith traditions and business people and artists and people who are living now and people who are historical inspirations. And just these 30 examples are worth the price of the book. So you've done a wonderful job in collecting those stories. And thank you for sharing those three with us. I hope they whet people's appetites for reading the other 27. So I have one short question. I hope question's short, and I'll ask you to just kind of briefly touch in your answer so that we can open this up shortly. One other question, and that is, near the end of the book, you talk kind of about the shadow side of generosity, and although your mission is to encourage greater generosity, you say sometimes it can be misguided or counterproductive. And what can we do to avoid that happening?
Well, indeed, I've written about responsible generosity, which I think is really the header under which this question fits. And the purpose of my book clearly is to encourage the embracing of generosity as a virtue. But I think we have to be aware, not just of evil and sinister forces, but aware that the mere desire to be generous is sometimes not enough if the goal is to truly help other people. And the truth is that too frequently generosity can be a fool's game, that its path is sometimes lined with traps and snares, that philanthropic generosity, personal giving, can be misguided and even at times counterproductive. And I go on to tell a number of stories about that I'm familiar with, work in the less developed countries, rat holes that money has been sunk into, expenditures, as are recorded in the book Silent Accomplice by Andrew Wallace, the journalist, about his time in Rwanda and all the errors there. The point is that I'm trying to make is that responsible generosity consists of more than mere good intentions. I don't think they're enough. So we need to steer clear of careless strategies, or I would argue ideologically motivated theories, and we need to follow through to examine the results of charitable giving. We need to take full responsibility for the use of donated resources. In short, responsibility has to be viewed as a sort of subspecies of stewardship. Because if there's one lesson on generosity to learn from this sort of 50-year global experience in the post-World War II period, it may be that even the most entrepreneurial wealth creators, and I talk at length about many of them in this book, need to give more careful attention to the execution of their giving in order for it to be effective. And I think effective giving is really what it's all about. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of a warning label that goes out in that chapter. So that while we're trying to certainly persuade and encourage generosity, we ought to be mindful of what we're giving to. We ought to do due diligence, and we ought to really follow through and make sure that it's most effective.
Thank you so much. I hope that these questions and your answers have sparked some comments and questions from people who are on the call listening. So let's open it up now, and if you who are a participant on the call would like to ask Ted a question or respond to some things that Ted has said, ask that you keep your comments fairly short so that other people get a chance to participate as well. And say your name first. You may need to unmute to do star 6. So just tell Ted who you are and then make your comment or question. So it's now open.
Hello, Ted?
Yes.
Ted, this is Peter Pintas from Colorado Springs. First of all, thank you. I appreciate what you're sharing with the rest of the group. It's fantastic information and something we all need to be thinking about. The question I have is that a lot of your examples are related to individual generosity. Do you have any thoughts regarding how an organization might demonstrate the virtue of generosity?
Yes, I have many ideas and many examples in the book. Obviously, there are philanthropic foundations, which I address at some length. There are some not-for-profits that give us very interesting illustrations. I have a chapter on the generous society, so I actually believe that generosity is contagious and that it could be filtered into even the policies of a country or of a nation state or of even a local entity for that matter. I also I didn't spell them out in great detail here, a number of ideas about how corporations can be more generous. And one of those has to do less with the phenomena with which I'm familiar, and I spend most of my life in that kind of corporate arena, whereby the CEO or his or her wife chooses which charity gets a fairly healthy prize at the end of the year. I like these programs in corporate giving that are matching programs. In other words, that set aside a fairly large block of money that is given to match the charitable giving of their own employees. And I think those really are quite exciting.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Olivia Parrud. I'm from Philadelphia, and I really enjoyed what you were talking about, and I can't wait to read your book. I have a couple comments. Just this morning, Ralph Nader was on the local radio station. I actually called him and talked to him, and he's just written a book called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, and it's really kind of a novel, but it's great, a great way of stimulating thinking around how maybe Ted Turner or Barry Diller or Ono could put their money towards, you know, really helping and sort of pioneering generosity. And when I was a kid, this will show my age, but there was a show called The Millionaire where this guy would give people money, maybe you remember this, and, you know, what it would do to their lives. And I think popular culture is such a way, great way to inspire a change of behavior, and I wonder if there's any movement or even thoughts about creating some sort of a television show that would create stories around people being generous and all the amazing things that could come of that. So I have that as a question, if anybody's ever thought of that.
Yeah, well, let me pick up on that, and I'm from Philadelphia, so good thoughts usually coming out of Philadelphia would be my first comment. And to mention someone else's book, because this is a phenomenon we should look at, the editor of The Economist magazine, Matthew Bishop, last year came out with a book called Philanthrocapitalism, in which he makes probably a more empirical kind of argument of the sort that you mentioned. And I would say there's some increasing evidence of this. I recorded in my own book, but you see now on television a show called The Philanthropists, which I'm not sure how good it is, but it is nonetheless a kind of action series about philanthropy, which was probably unheard of in the last number of years. Now it exists. And you have Oprah, I think, which is, and I do document her at length in my book, a very large phenomenon, and her reality television show, The Big Give, which is, in fact, exactly what you mentioned, a show based on giving away something instead of either stealing it or trying to win it from somebody else.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, thank you. That's great. Then the other comment I had, which is how corporations can help, is actually giving people time off to go and volunteer. And I wondered if you've seen that or if it's on the increase or the decrease as far as, you know, corporate policy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that is very much an American phenomenon. So you see some companies and some notable ones that have such policies, and they're very beneficial. I have done work with CNN, and I know, for example, they have allowed employees to be involved in mentoring and teaching students in Atlanta and other cities where they're present, and that has been encouraged, and it has been, I think, quite demonstrable. So it's another, it goes to the argument that Judy and I were making about generosity also involving time and talent, not just money.
Right. Thank you.
Hi, it's Jonathan Reams here calling from Norway. And earlier I heard you speaking about kind of the depth or the core quality of generosity as part of human nature. And I wonder how you might reflect on that in relation to altruism. And I brought that up because as you were talking, I recall reading something lately that talked about altruism as what defines us as being human and not just animals.
Well, it's a very good point, and I would concur with it. I have a whole chapter in this book on generosity and actually the science of generosity. So there have been I won't bore you with all of them, but there have been many animal studies, including large apes, where very famous people have studied those behaviors, and there's really a lot to take away from it. And it seems more and more evident if you look at those studies and if you look at particularly the findings in what's called positive psychology, the work of Marty Seligman at the University of Pennsylvania and some of his colleagues, and Stephen Post, who has written this very brilliant book, Why Good Things Happen to Good People. Last year he wrote the book. You find the argument that those who are altruistic and those who are attempting to be virtuous and exhibit this particularly important virtue of generosity, live lives that are not only definably more moral, but are longer, are healthier, and one could argue, although I don't think we have the best handle on this yet, also much more full of joy than those that are not.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm familiar with those two references, and one that I've come across lately as well is some research on neurocardiology that looks at the relationship between the attitudes we hold, such as appreciation and compassion, and the state of the kind of brain in our heart, and how it actually creates more coherence and better health from holding those attitudes as well. So there's maybe some correlation between that research as well.
No, it's very interesting how these things kind of come together. From the different sciences, I mean, not that any one of them has the whole story, but when you weave them together into a complete picture, a bigger fabric, there's some very interesting findings. I recount some of those from people like Paul Zak, for instance, who is I predict will win the Nobel Prize someday for his work on oxytocin, which is the hormone that enhances attachment between partners and also between mothers and children. And some of the research in the fields of neuropsychology, and I also mentioned at length Martin Nowak, who is now at Harvard, who's done all this research on evolutionary dynamics. So there's some really incredible new work that's being created, and it does tend to point in the direction that we're suggesting here, that that generosity is in fact, I sum it up in a paragraph, just two sentences in this chapter. I say, in sum, being generous, giving to others without expecting anything in return, that's the point, is not just the right thing to do, it's also a very practical thing for those who want to feel healthier, be happier, and live longer. And more, this conclusion is being demonstrated not merely as an optimistic idea, but as a scientific fact.
Thank you so much. This is Judith. And we have time for one more question, and then I will do a closing reading and ask Ted to make some closing comments. So one more question or comment from someone? Remember, star 6 will unmute you if you're muted. If we're not hearing any questions, let me make a couple of announcements, and maybe someone still might have a question or comment. I did want to let you know that if you'd like to purchase Being Generous, the place you can go, I'm sure it's on Amazon.com, but the publisher is Templeton Press, and their website is www.templetonpress.org. And Ted, is there anything else you'd like to say about where people can find out more about your work?
No. I think that the book has an outlines and descriptions of the kinds of things I'm working on.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I would say that I am giving a live web streamed address on October 22nd. At the Center on Philanthropy at Indiana University in Indianapolis, which will be streamed live on GuideStar, which is very generous. Of course, they're a very noted website for not-for-profit information. And I think I mentioned, if I haven't, that the royalties and proceeds from this book, which is quite legitimate, go to another great charity called Global Giving, and their website is www.globalgiving.com, and they are their logo is the marketplace for goodness. So, very fascinating, in fact, internet a giving opportunity along the lines that I've described in the book.
Wonderful, and. In the future, you'll be doing some more work with Spiritual Enterprise Institute. I mentioned in the beginning that maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. I know you're...
Sure. Well, the Spiritual Enterprise Institute, we founded 5 years ago with a large grant from the Templeton Foundation and a direct challenge, actually, from the late Sir John Templeton himself to me to look at the kind of moral fabric and the virtues that undergird corporations in today's world. So we have been doing that for, you know, these few short years, and I think the new news there, the new development is that we are going to be merging that work into Yale University, actually it's imminent in the next month, and we'll be taking a new form, and the Templeton Foundation has given us another very large and generous gift to research spiritual capital evidenced in business enterprise.
And that's so incredibly
exciting.
So
we will
exciting.
Be writing 24 case studies over the next 3 years.
And hopefully we can do some more teleconferences with you about some of the things you're learning, because that's just going to be incredibly valuable information for people who care about the integration of faith and spirituality in the workplace. So I'm excited about that. And I also wanted to tell people on this call, most of you have probably learned about the call because of receiving our Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace newsletter, or you may be a member of the Walton College community. And if you found out about it some other way and want to make sure that you get notices of future events, please email me at jneal, J-N-E-A-L, at walton.uark.edu, and that's Walton, W-A-L-T-O-N, .uark.edu, and I'll add you to the email list. So just a quick check to see if there's a short question or short comment before I read the closing quote and turn it over to Ted. Is there anything else anybody wanted to say?
Yes, Judy, this is Diane McGuire. I'm sorry I came on late, and I missed the name of the book, which is really essential.
It's called Being Generous.
Thank you.
By Ted Malloch, M-A-L-L-O-C-H.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay, so let me go ahead and go with the closing quote, and then I'll turn it over to you, Ted. Ted writes, "And so we can see that in virtually every tradition, religious as well as secular, humankind has known, every faith community on every continent and also among those who are agnostic or even atheistic, there exists a diverse set of teachings that emphasize generosity. Being generous is, I would therefore argue, not just a core part of the human condition, but a universal moral urge, our defining nature. Since generosity so defines our human nature, it is one of the few things in which people around the entire globe, though on different pathways, can agree." And I think you'll all agree with me that it was very inspiring to hear you speak, Ted, today, and thank you for the generosity of your time and your work, and also for being a model in being generous with the royalties and the proceeds from the book and teaching us more about ways in which we can give. God bless you. I want to turn this over to you now, and we'll end.
Well, thank you for this opportunity. I guess I would just make a personal challenge at the end, as I did in the book, and I would challenge each of you to consider with greater urgency the virtue of generosity and what it means to your own life and to the organizations you're part of, to think about its potential to bring hope and comfort to others and joy to your own life, and to consider what it might, that it might just lie at the center of the very purpose for which we have been created. And then I would wish an end here that all of you find peace and fulfillment on that journey.
Great. Thank you so much, Ted. Thank you, everyone, for being on the call. And have a really wonderful and heartfelt and giving day. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Bye. Thank you, Judy. Thank you, Ted.